Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I'm Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
That's right, Joel. This is a Listener Question Monday episode, an Ask How to Money episode. We've got five great questions today, including a listener who sent in his own Frugal or Cheap. I'm actually really excited to talk about that one here in a second. We've got another one from a couple who is talking about how to go about combining their finances. And we also have another question about balance transfer credit cards. I'm looking forward to tackling those three plus a couple others. But first, I wanted to share a little story with you.
Oh, story time with Matt. my favorite segment of the podcast.
So in the past, we've made fun of writing checks before. Checks, they're kind of going the way of the dodo. And literally last night, I wrote a check, and I'll explain to you the story of how that happened. So basically, long story short, I'm not going to dive into all the details for Kate's sake, but she got a ticket. Ticket that we couldn't contest it. Like, we just had to pay it, right? So I'm sitting down last night getting ready to pay some bills. I pull up the site to pay that ticket, to pay that bill, and the credit card processing fee was $12. It's like sometimes.
Ouch.
Sometimes.
What was the percentage then?
It was way more than it should have been. I'll just say that it was not representative of, even if I would have been able to get like massive cash back. I did all the math. Trust me, wouldn't cover it. It definitely would not have covered it.
Okay.
And just the principle of paying that much money for it to be a little more convenient, I could not believe it. And I was looking over the form that I got in the mail, and I saw in really fine print towards the bottom, it said that you could also mail in a paper check, and there were no additional fees
except for the price of a stamp
associated with that
and the envelope.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, and even the envelope came with it.
Oh, there you go.
And so I wanted to mention that because, again, we will often scoff at the idea of paper checks. I think there's a lot of folks out there who may have only ever written a couple checks in their entire life. But this is a good argument for keeping some checks on hand. It's not like we're saying that you should never write a single check again. You should just take your checkbook and rip it up or burn it or anything like that. This was a great example of why keeping just your checkbook on hand, even though you may not use it all that often, could save you real money. Because I'm not going to lie, I was tempted to say, you know what, like, I'm just going to pay it and not worry about it. Just going to eat the cost so I can not think about it. But the principle of it just kept gnawing at me. And I was just like, there's no way that I can live with myself if I were to actually pay that. So I opened the drawer, pulled out the check, wrote it, and it's in the mail as of today.
There you go. Well, I'm with you on that usage of checks. I have some in the drawer at the bank that I do most of my banking with. They provide free checks. And 10 years ago, that seemed like an awesome benefit. And now it's like, oh man, I almost never have to actually order checks because, like you, I'm probably writing one, maybe two checks a year.
Yeah, like, but one checkbook is good for 10 years. Right. Is what it feels like right now.
Exactly. But it is nice to have them on hand just in case. And if it means being able to avoid some frustrating fee, then I would say, yeah, break out your checkbook. Make it happen.
Yeah, $12. That's the cost of a nice beer.
That's right. Exactly. Speaking of which, on today's episode, we're drinking a Bell's Two Hearted. This is an American IPA. And a big thanks to our friend Chris, who works for Bell's, who donated these beers to the show. Thanks to Bell's, they make great beers. So we're looking forward to having this classic on the show.
We'll, a classic indeed.
Yeah, give our thoughts on it at the end of the episode.
Classic like a checkbook.
Old school, but...
A little more old school, but...
Still reliable.
Fantastic. Yeah.
All right, well, let's get on to the listener questions, Matt. For anybody out there who is listening and they're like, I've got a question, a money question I'd love Matt and Joel to tackle, we would love to hear it. And you can submit your question at howtomoney.com. And there are super simple instructions for how to submit your question for us to take on an upcoming episode at howtomoney.com/ask. But let's get to the first one. And this one is that frugal or cheap question that Matt mentioned.
Hey guys, Matt here from Phoenix, Arizona. Just had a quick frugal or cheap for you guys that I'd like to get your opinions on. Last week I was in a Target store with my daughter who is 12, and we remembered that she needed a new bike helmet. So we went and found the bike helmets. We found one in her size. They didn't have a huge selection, but we found one that had a color that she liked. It was teal and pink, and it was $32. As we were leaving, we noticed that there was a clearance section there on the end cap, and the exact same helmet with a different color was on clearance. It was $11. The difference was it was pink instead of teal and pink. She was not super thrilled about the pink helmet. So I had to debate with her for about 10 minutes going over things like the two helmets are the same. They're just different colors. One of them isn't safer than the other one or better than the other one. They're literally exactly the same. And we're going to get the $11 one unless you want to pay the difference between the two helmets. You're welcome to do that. Like I said, it took about 10 minutes. Finally got her to agree to the $11 one, even though she was not super thrilled about it. Anyway, just wondering, do you think I was being frugal or cheap in that situation? Anyway, thanks for the show. Take care.
All right, Matt, this is an easier frugal or cheap, I would say, than getting a used helmet.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I was like, what are you going to compare this to?
Because that would be, that'd be one of those questions where, you know, you're probably going to end up being cheap.
You're being a little cheap.
Yeah.
Yep.
But let's get to Matt's question. First, I love that he and his family, they're prioritizing biking.
Totally. Yeah.
That, of course, is going to pay dividends for years to come in so many different areas of your life. And so, yeah, your health as you bike more is something that gets you moving and off the couch. Your relationships, not only to each other as a family, going on family bike rides together, which I did last night to the playground with my kiddos. It was... delightful. Those are the kind of things that help foster and build relationships. They create just a lot of fun memories for you and your daughter. And it's also just the relationships you foster by getting out in your own neighborhood, seeing your neighbors, seeing people in the front yard, stopping those chance encounters to have a conversation. It's tough, almost impossible to beat all of the good things that biking has to offer. So first, I just want to say, Matt and his family, they're on the right track trying to make this just like a regular part of their lives.
Oh, yeah. Not to mention all the money that you can save by not having to pay for wear and tear on a vehicle, paying for gas, which is, I mean, expensive as ever these days. Just this morning, dropped the kids off at school. That is one less trip that I have to fund with a trip to the gas station. But Matt, let's kind of get to your question. And, you know, I think whether it's frugal or cheap sort of come down to a few different things. First of all, one question you can ask is whether or not you're spending your own money on this helmet. And, you know, in your case, you are. And so, like, I do totally get the disappointment that a kid feels when they've picked something out that they love and then the parent maybe opts for the cheaper alternative that maybe may not be quite as appealing to the kiddo. But if the parents are the ones who are paying for it, and as long as you are talking to her about the decision that you're making, then I think that this is one reason to say that this is definitely a frugal move, not the cheap move, because in the end, parents are the ones who are calling the shots here.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you're right, Matt, to point out the fact that he communicated well with his daughter about it. I think if you just said, no, that's it, like, we're getting the cheaper one, let's get out of here, and she's left there trying to process emotionally what happened, like, she thought that they had picked out this bike helmet and now she's like, I gotta go with this other one. And but the fact that you were able to really walk her through it and explain it to her and take the time, I feel like that's actually the perfect place to teach a money lesson, a finance lesson about the value of money and the trade-offs that we all have to make with the money that we earn, even though it can be hard as a parent to teach right in the middle of that emotional moment. But the main reason that it's frugal and not cheap is also that you offered her the option to contribute her own money to make up for the gap in price. And that didn't seem to interest her, which she felt passionately about buying the helmet based on the color alone and spending an extra $20 or whatever the difference was exactly. That's the perfect opportunity for her to use the money that she's made and to make that a priority. And it sounds like she made a wise choice too by not opting to do that and by taking a slightly inferior color. But yeah, I think these are the kind of teaching moments that parents need to use in order to help their kids understand personal finances better, understand the trade-offs that have to be made because, you know, they're the finite resource that money is in all of our lives.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is that there was such a difference in price, right, between the helmet that was on clearance and the one that was in the colors that she wanted. Like, I know that when we teach lessons, they should be based on principles. But the fact that this helmet that was on clearance, that it was over $20 more affordable, just makes this another reason that I think, Matt, that you made the frugal choice. Because I'll be honest, there are times when I might be tempted to kind of just let something slide. Like, if it was only a couple bucks of difference, right? But this was an instance where, you know, you made the right decision for multiple reasons. It was the right reason from a principal standpoint, but also, too, like, that was real money that was on the line. And again, your ability to talk through that with her, I think, is super important, right? I mean, and there's just the whole consumption side of things, too, because oftentimes the way we decide that something has or doesn't have value is oftentimes based on price. And I think for her, starting to go down that path of explaining to her that, like, you know, this helmet isn't any worse or any better than the other one. The colors are just different.
Yeah.
And just explaining, basically just getting her to think through the fact that just because something is more or less expensive doesn't make it an inferior or superior product. Because that's what marketers want us to believe. That's what advertising does, right? Like, you've got the new shiny thing. And again, it was probably in the section of the aisle where it was organized neatly.
Well lit.
compared to the end of the aisle, maybe on the back side of it, kind of like in the armpit section of Target, you know, like where things are all disheveled, half the products are kind of on the ground. And so you could perceive that those are inferior products, but in this case, that was not true.
Yeah, and I think you're right, Matt, the price difference matters, because $20 versus $2 is a big difference. Like, if it was a $2 difference and it was me and my daughter, I'd be, and she was like, but I like this color better. I would either ask her to pay the $2 or I would just pay it myself because it's $2. But when it's a $20 difference, when it's like, it costs over more than 100% more, that's the perfect reason to point out a price discrepancy that's that large. Yeah. And just like going back to you paying that ticket, it's like, if it was a $2 fee,
I probably would have eaten it.
You would have eaten it.
Yeah.
But when it's a $12 fee, it's like, nope, that's too much. There's a breaking point for all of us.
Exactly, yeah. And the other thing, too, I think even being willing to, like, I may have been willing to split the difference with her, right? And so if she was just like, hey, okay, there's a $20 difference here, but this time it's only $11. You were willing to spend $30, you know, if like a kid had that kind of negotiating negotiation skills, I'd be like, okay, well, that's a pretty good argument.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But I think I may have been willing to be like, hey, I'll split the difference with you. I will pitch in $10 if you pitch in an extra $10 and get us from that $11 helmet to the $31 helmet or whatever.
Yeah.
But basically, I guess maybe that's the part of it that's on my mind, is the fact that he was willing originally to buy the $30, you know, plus helmet. And so maybe a good way to kind of land the lesson and kind of like really bring it home is if he took that extra money that he obviously had, he was willing to spend that on a helmet, but then put that money towards something else to where his daughter could see, hey, there are trade-offs, just like you said, Joel, right? So instead of putting this toward that helmet that you wanted, maybe he would buy a snack in the checkout line, or maybe once they get home and put, you know, and went for a bike ride, maybe they go and get ice cream, but something where he can be like, look, the reason that we're doing this is because we got the more affordable helmet. Isn't this great, right?
What if she's like, nah, I wanted the helmet. That would have been better.
Well, I mean, whatever it takes, though, to connect the fact that there are trade-offs and there are other things that you can do with that money. Because if she doesn't get to realize that saved money, that's where I think the disconnect can happen. And that might be the instance where she's like, Dad, you're so cheap. You're not being frugal
that's
here.
That's when you show her that you're able to max out your Roth IRA this year because you didn't buy that helmet. But no, and I got to say, like, this is the exact kind of thing that my parents did when I was a kid. Like, I always loved Nike basketball shoes that usually a star player had just released. Matt, Scottie Pippen shoes were the best shoes when I was in middle school, at least according to those middle school tastes that I no longer have. But my parents, they didn't have the money to pay for those shoes. They had budgeted an amount that they really had to stick to for myself and my sisters when it came to like our footwear. And even if they did have the money, I don't think they would have bought me the fanciest shoes on the block. I just don't think that they would have allowed that to happen. I think they had other principled reasons to avoid spending $120, $150 on a pair of shoes, which I completely agree with. But that,
now, as a parent, you're like, oh, I totally get it.
But that meant that I had to make a choice similar to Matt's daughter. And like, did I want those shoes enough to spend my own birthday and Christmas money on them? Like, that was a big, big choice for me as a little dude with limited funds. And every once in a while, I did. I distinctly remember getting this one pair when I was a kid, and they were great. But I also was like, man, I can't do this every year. And every kid at my school, or a lot of the kids at my school, have these fancy shoes. But I've got this one pair, and I'm gonna like make them last as long as I can. But most of the time, I just had to realize I couldn't afford the fancy shoes. It just wasn't possible. There were other things I wanted to buy. There were other trade-offs. Yeah. And I think that is a good lesson, actually. Ultimately, it's tough to let your kid down in the moment. They're hard lessons to teach sometimes, but they're the right lessons in the end. And it does take a little bit of heartbreak on occasion, or just emotional difficulty to wade through those things. But that's what parenting's all about. And teaching the right lessons isn't always easy.
Going back to your shoes, your sneakers example, I could totally picture you as like a middle school kid, and somebody like kind of scuffs your shoe a little bit with some dirt, and you like lick your thumb and get down there and like rub it off. You're like, oh, come on, man, these are brand new. But no, I couldn't agree with you more. And Matt, I hope we got you pointed in the right direction. We think that you made the right decision, but it comes down to how we go about teaching our kids these lessons and making sure that they understand our heart behind what it is that we're making them do or not do and the rules that we're imposing on them. All right, that's just our first question. We've got a couple more that we're going to get to right after the break, including one about maxing out retirement accounts. We'll get to that one, plus that relationship question right after this.
All right, we're back, and let's keep taking listener questions. This one comes from a listener in California who just got married.
Hey, Joel and Matt, this is Jad. I'm from Chino Hills, California. I've been listening to you guys for a couple of months now, and it's been a great experience so far, and I've learned so much. So I'm just curious to know what your guys' experiences were like at the first few months after marriage, when you're trying to update your W-4 and trying to figure out income and debt situation. So my husband and I recently got married, and we both have student loan debt, and I am the only one earning right now. He is still finishing his doctorate program and will be accumulating about $300,000 worth of debt. I have about $60,000 left. And so whenever we get into a conversation about combining income and combining debt, it gets a little bit difficult. So I'm just curious to know what your guys' experience were like. Any input will be appreciated. Thank you so much for taking the time. Have a great day.
Hey, Jad, we are so glad that you are learning some stuff after listening to Joel and I blab on for a few months now.
If people walk away from this podcast and they haven't learned a darn thing, that means we failed.
Means we're not doing our job. But we appreciate you listening. And let's talk about those first few months after marriage. By the way, congrats on getting married. But let's get personal here for a little bit. Because, and I'm not going to lie, this first couple of marriage years are lovely in many respects. But there's also a massive learning curve on not just the financial front, but in many other areas of life. And one of the biggest things that you're trying to figure out, of course, is how to handle your money together. And I think, too, you know, the later in life that you get married, the harder it can be to mesh on this front when it comes to your money. That's why a lot of couples, they actually keep their finances separate. But that actually is not the route that either Joel took with his wife, Emily, or that I took with my wife, Kate.
Yeah, we decided, we believed, we thought that for our marriage, the best thing was to combine finances. And like Matt said, we realized that's not the route that everyone takes. That's not the best route necessarily for everyone. Not everyone believes or thinks the way we do about this. But we will offer our thoughts, a couple of thoughts that might come across as potentially more traditional. You can call us old school. That's okay. but when you're combining lives, which is what marriage is, you really are saying like, hey, we're all in together. We're also fans of combining finances. When you're deciding to do life together, you should do finances together. And so, yeah, the later in life you're getting married, the more difficult it is to do. Like Matt said, if you're 43 and you've been flying solo for 20 years and you have a massively established career, I get the reticence to combine everything, right? Like, it's a little bit different combining at 26 versus 46. And especially if you're in completely different financial stratospheres. But I got to say, I believe that things change in a big way once you're married. You're no longer two separate entities. You really have gone all in together, 100% in on each other. And it's not to say that you can't both have separate interests or anything like that. But when it comes to the big things, you're unified. You're attempting to work through things together as a unit. And I think that this means combining everything is the best way to go for most people. Everything from assets to liabilities, income that you're making to the debt that your husband's accruing while he's still in school, those are all things now that I would say you hold in common.
Yeah, totally. I mean, Jad, I think it might even be helpful, too, if instead of viewing it as your student loans and his student loans, that you just simply think of them as like your collective debt that you both owe together. You know, like a lot of Southerners say, you just call it like y'all's debt. That's what folks down here in Georgia say. And then, you know, when the time comes that your husband is contributing to the household income, like that is also the collective income of your family. It's not going to be his income. It's 100% your income as well. And so, of course, I mean, money, it's really important. But when you really take a step back here and you look at your relationship overall, money should be a relatively small part of this big picture. You know, we feel that there are more central aspects of a relationship, like your commitment to each other, that are more important to focus on now. And then hopefully over time, the money differences that you have, that those things can be worked out. But right now, if you only focus on the difficult conversation of just what to do with your money in this one specific way, I'm afraid that like you'd only be addressing one specific aspect of your relationship instead of getting down to the core of what it is that we want you to focus on.
Yeah, I mean, I think these money combos, especially, Matt, you mentioned the early years of marriage being tough. They are tough. And getting on the same page on a whole host of things as you've now like attempted to combine lives, like it's not going to be easy. And it takes a lot of conversation, some trial and error to get on the same page. You have to work together. You have to try to find common ground. You have to push through the difficulty and not say, that's too tough a topic. We're just never going to get on the same page. There's still a lot of hope that you can get on the same page, even on a topic like money. And yeah. I would suggest too, sometimes having a third party, including them, in those conversations can be helpful. Probably not like your mom. Like, you don't want the mother-in-law to be the third party in that combo. But
sure.
It could be a trusted older couple that you guys have bonded with, that you have a lot of respect for, and you think they do things the way, or their marriage looks kind of like you want your marriage to look like, that incorporating them and asking them some of these questions and letting them help guide you when it comes to a lot of things, but money could be one of them.
Totally.
Can be helpful. It might even be, honestly, like a marriage therapist. That could be, that might be the right person to turn to as well. But I think it's not always easy, and it's fine to start slow. Like, you don't have to get on the same page overnight. But we would say, having one account that you both put money into for mutual bills, while at least for the time being, keeping something separate while you're both adjusting, it can make sense. And you might always keep that arrangement, but you might decide over time to combine everything together as the years move on. Just don't neglect to have those hard conversations, because they're hard. They are conversations that need to happen. And pushing through those hard things actually leads to, I think, better pastures when it comes to what your marriage looks like.
And we don't often offer relationship advice here, but Jad, you asked for our opinions, and this is what we have done, and this is what we believe, at least for us. And so that's one of the many opinions that you can gather as you seek to have a healthy relationship with your husband. Joel, our next question comes from a listener who seems to be doing a pretty good job with his money, but he does want to make sure that he's focusing on the right retirement vehicle. Let's hear that question.
Hey Matt and Joel, Jason returning with a question on retirement. I'm 45, my wife is 44, and we have $754,000 in retirement at this point. $259,000 is in a ESOP account through my employer, and the other $495,000 is in my 401k. Question is, money gear number two, match 401k. And my question is versus maxing your 401k. My employer matches 75 cents on the dollar for the first $3,000 and 50 cents on the dollar for the next $2,000. So my question is regarding your thoughts on maxing it versus matching it. Should I only match it and move the other money to a Roth IRA? Thanks, and I appreciate your feedback.
All right, Matt, I know where I'm going if I need $20. I'm going to ask Jason for money. Jason, you are...
Jason's crushing it.
You're crushing it, dude. You really are. You're doing great with your money. And yeah, I'm not sure if you care, but you're well above average when it comes to how much money you've socked away at your age. And so this just gives you a plethora of options, like being able to choose how much you want to work sooner rather than later, being able to quit altogether in the near future, if you wanted to, in all likelihood. And so, yeah, depending on what your expenses look like, here's the thing. You might not actually need to prioritize maxing out your 401k contributions, but that just really comes down to your personal goals. And so there's definitely going to have to be, when you're deciding, well, how much more do I continue to sock away? A lot of that answer is going to come down to, well, what do you want the next 5, 10, 15 years of your life to look like?
Yeah, it depends on what your personal goals are. It depends where you're going to retire, because there's a big difference if you're going to retire in San Francisco versus Memphis, Tennessee.
Or Thailand.
Or Thailand, yeah. But Jason, let's talk about money gear number two. You talked about the money gear, so let's kind of use that framework here. Getting the match is the minimum that you want to be hitting for all the folks out there who are listening who may not have heard us talk about the money gears before. And so that's why it is so early on within our money gears. Getting that full match that your employer offers should be a major priority for everyone pretty early on. Some call it free money. Others will call it, you know, part of your benefits package that you should be taking advantage of. But no matter how you refer to it, it's an incredibly helpful wealth-building tool that you can't afford to leave on the table. And honestly, it's going to be the best, most guaranteed return on your money that you'll ever realize. And so you're already doing that, but now you're talking about whether you should continue to fund that 401k or if you should instead move on to other tax-advantaged accounts. But before we kind of talk about those, you kind of skipped over money gears number three and four. And so we're going to assume that you do not have any high interest rate debt. We're going to assume that you have a fully funded emergency fund. And then we will progress on to money gear number five.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Money gear number five. And when it comes to the order of operations, Jason, what I'd say is contribute enough to get the full match that you're entitled to, like Matt said, no matter what. But after that, I'd put as much money as I possibly could into your Roth IRA with a goal to max that out, if at all possible. So if you can hit the match and then max out your Roth, which the contribution limits are $6,000 a year, if you are under the income threshold, that's where you should go next. And so the reason I would say to go with the Roth IRA is that it gives you some tax diversification because you'll be starting to create pre and post-tax buckets. And that just gives you a whole lot more flexibility to dial in your tax rate decades down the road when you're starting to live off of the retirement funds that you've accrued.
Yep.
And my parents, they're like on the verge of complete retirement soon. And we're talking about that. And just the fact that they have almost equivalent buckets of pre and post-tax money.
Very nice.
Yeah, it just gives them a whole lot of flexibility in what they want their tax rate to be. They basically get to choose their own adventure on that. And I think it is a nice place to be to at least have some pre-tax, some post-tax to pull from when you get that age.
Yeah, we definitely like having that diversity. Maybe you can refer to this money gear as maybe like money gear 5A. And if that's the case, then 5B would be like after, you know, if you do max out that Roth IRA and then you still have money left over, then go back to your 401k and then start funneling even more dollars beyond that match level in there. So at that point, you'd be moving from match to max. And like we mentioned at the beginning of our answer, you know, like there is a decent reason for you to not invest every single dollar you possibly can. You've already built up an excellent nest egg, and it's okay to choose to incorporate some more of those dollars into your life now, trying to maybe strike a balance of investing for the future and living your life to the fullest today. Make sure that you don't neglect your craft beer equivalent. You know, we're not trying to dissuade you from the awesome investing moves that you're making. We just want you to make sure that you are thinking about, you know, what life looks like now, making sure that you've got some food for thought. We don't want you to over-prioritize investing for the long term because, as we all know, we're not guaranteed tomorrow. And so you've got to find that balance between doing things in the here and now and also doing things for the long term.
Yeah, that balance. So hard to find, but it sounds like Jason has already done an awesome job with his retirement savings. And so there's a lot of wiggle room. There are a lot of options open to him. So Jason, best of luck getting at least the match and then moving on and investing more from there. But Matt, we've got a couple more questions to go to, including someone who is in retirement. And they're wondering, well, how do I now start to pull those funds out? We'll get to that question. And it involves starting to claim Social Security. We'll get to that right after this break.
We are back from the break, and we're going to take a question here in a second about credit card balance transfers. But before we get to that one, let's take this question about retirement.
Hi, Joel and Matt. This is Sandy from Massachusetts. I'm a longtime listener, and I love your podcast. My question has to do with retirement, not for myself, but for an older sibling who is looking to retire sometime in the next 3 to 4 years. We seem to have some debate about what he should tap first and in which order. In this case, he is questioning whether he should wait to file for Social Security until he gets a little closer to age 72, and in the meantime, withdraw 401k funds to support his lifestyle. Other people in my family suggest he should file for Social Security when he's 68 and hold off on tapping his 401k. So what is the conventional wisdom on which things you should access first when you finally make a decision to retire? Should you prioritize withdrawing money from, say, a brokerage account first, or from a 401k, or from a Roth IRA? And how do you feel about where Social Security fits in all of this? I know this is a pretty big topic, but any advice you have would be appreciated. Thank you.
All right, Sandy, I appreciate your question. And Matt, let's get nerdy with this one. It's actually something that I've been thinking about quite a bit because my parents are facing this exact same question about how and when to pull money for retirement. And so, I don't know, let's go and weigh in on my family dispute and Sandy's family dispute at the same time.
Let's do it.
Two birds with one stone. And waiting to take Social Security. That is something that it's really, really important when it comes to how you think about income in retirement. Waiting as long as you can to take Social Security is almost always the best way to maximize that income in retirement. I say almost always because there are some circumstances where it does make sense to take money earlier. For instance, married couples, they might decide to start collecting one Social Security payment early and then delay taking the Social Security for the higher earning spouse. Or you might decide that because of the state of your health, waiting to take Social Security doesn't really make sense for you. You don't want to wait until you're age 70 because you want to be able to quit work now and you're not quite sure that your health is going to be around for you and right. You're not going to be around potentially into your 90s. And basically, if that provides enough income and gives you the lifestyle choices you want, then we would say go in that direction. But this doesn't seem to be the case for Sandy's brother. And Sandy, you're asking about pulling the right levers to maximize retirement income, which is a nerdy conversation we like to have. So let's do our best to help your family thread that needle.
You know, also I wanted to say that Sandy, she mentioned age 72, but Sandy, your brother doesn't need to wait that long. Age 70, that is the time that he should pull the trigger in order to receive the maximum benefit possible from Social Security. Don't wait any longer because the benefit actually won't get any bigger if he does. The thing about waiting until age 70 to opt in is that a retiree receives an additional 8% a year in benefit if they continue to delay. So not only will your Social Security check be instantly bigger, but all those cost of living adjustments will be based on that higher amount as well. And so just kind of take a step back. Ask yourself, like, where else can you get a guaranteed 8% return these days? Virtually nowhere. And, you know, when you look at the longevity likelihood, people hitting that retirement age, there's a really good chance that you actually are going to come out ahead.
Yeah, so deciding to take Social Security benefits starting at age 70 is ideal if it's best for your situation. And even if it means exceeding the 4% rule for a few years so that he can delay taking Social Security, we think that's a solid move. And for our listeners who are like, what's the 4% rule? Understandable question. That basically states that in order to make sure that you don't outlive the money that you've accumulated to spend in retirement, drawing down at most 4% from those retirement funds every year is the way that you're going to basically ensure that you're not going to outlive your money. But Sandy, this is actually what I am recommending to my parents when it comes to those other retirement accounts and which order you'll pull money from. Well, I'm okay with them exceeding the 4% rule for a few years in order to get that guaranteed 8% increase in that Social Security benefit payout. But when it comes to those other retirement accounts and which order you're going to pull money from, it depends a lot on what sort of income you have coming in. Basically, you want to structure your withdrawals to pay the least amount of tax possible, not just in a given year, but over an extended period of time. Obviously, you're not going to pay tax on Roth IRA withdrawals, but if you took those all at once, you would lose your ability to basically choose your own tax rate in the future. So each year, you're going to want to take some potentially from each bucket in order to dial in that perfect tax bill each year for a decade or longer.
Totally. And look closely too at the tax brackets and base those withdrawal amounts in which accounts you take the withdrawals from on which tax bracket you want to slide into. This might be a little confusing. It can get a bit complicated. You might even want to pay some money and spend a few hours with a fee-only financial professional, someone who specializes in this type of maneuver. This is something that you can DIY and succeed at. And if you're trying to do this yourself and maybe you're looking for more reassurance as to knowing all the different specific considerations that you need to keep in mind when it comes to your Social Security. You can go to a specific site like MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com, and that's only going to cost your brother $40, and that's a good way for him to consider all of the specifics that the Social Security Administration will take into account as they're determining his benefits.
All right, Sandy, best of luck to you and your brother as he nears retirement. Congrats to him on being able to quit
and
work.
And congrats, exactly.
Yeah. So, all right, well, let's get to, we got one more question in this episode, and this one is about credit cards.
Hi, this is Will from Oakland, California. My question is regarding balance transfers. We have a large upcoming expense, and my thought is to put it all on a credit card and then pay half of that credit card balance using savings from the emergency fund, and for the other half of that balance to use a balance transfer to spread out those payments over 15 or 18 months. I'm wondering if you think that is a sound strategy and if you can recommend any particular balance transfer cards that offer the most favorable terms and the lowest fees. Thanks so much. Love the show. Bye.
Hey, Will, we appreciate you listening to the podcast, and thank you for sending in your question. It's actually been a minute since we've talked about balance transfer credit cards, and so I'm excited that you asked this one. And first of all, I wanted to address something that you mentioned. You said that you're planning to pay for half of this upcoming expense with your savings, but you also mentioned that it would be coming out of your emergency fund. And I hate to get nitpicky here.
Oh, you love to get nitpicky, Matt.
The details are important. Hopefully, this was an expense that you were able to foresee on the horizon, and you were able to actually work towards this savings goal. Because, you know, big expenses like a home repair, medical procedure even. These are all types of big-ticket items that we want the HTMers out there to be proactively working towards, and not just completely relying on your emergency fund for some of these irregular expenses that come up occasionally.
Yeah, exactly. We've talked about that. We want emergency funds to be for emergencies and not for like, oops, forgot about that. We want you to be regularly budgeting in those types of items. And even if, you know, that's the kind of thing that you only pay for once every 2 or 3 years, it needs to somehow, you know, be something that you're saving for.
That's right.
And not just coming out of that e-fund, because that's how it gets depleted more rapidly.
Exactly. World Cup tickets several years from now. I am saving for those right now.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing we want a lot of folks to be doing with when it comes to other expenses as well.
Yeah, it's not going to be pulled out of your e-fund. You're saving for it. Even
Kate, it's an emergency.
Far in advance. But on the other side of the coin, if this actually was something that came out of nowhere, then by all means, of course, use money out of your emergency funds, right? These are the kinds of events and unforeseen expenses that emergency funds are made for. So to some, this might be an obvious statement. It's something that you generally understand. But once you find yourself in the heat of the moment, it can be difficult to actually use that money for its intended purpose. We can get so preoccupied in making sure that we have the perfect, fully funded emergency fund in our account that we're a little gun shy when it comes to actually using it. We see the same thing with our credit scores. We've worked so hard to get it boosted into a good range. You know, we've polished it up and now it looks spotless and perfect.
The perfect credit score sitting on the pedestal, under the glass jar, don't touch.
But at that point, it's become almost meaningless, right? Because in the process, we forget that there's going to come a time when we need to actually use our credit score for what it was intended for. It's a tool in the same way that an emergency fund is. And so let's make sure that we keep the same perspective on both.
Yep. Yeah. So that's all important stuff. Let's go ahead and get to like the root of Will's question here, which is using a balance transfer card a good strategy? And I think this would be a good idea for you, Will, only if you are not already dealing with credit card debt. You didn't mention that this is the case for you. And so hopefully that's not the situation you're in. But if there's someone out there listening and they've got a couple cards, maybe they're carrying balances on them month to month, then adding another credit card to the mix most likely isn't going to solve any problems. Instead, we think that that person needs to get to the root of the issue, whether that means increasing their income or most likely cutting back on their spending. And so, well, yeah, assuming you don't fall into that boat, the only other thing that you want to make sure is that you are being diligent to pay off that balance within the allotted window of time that you have, whether that's 12 months or 18, even sometimes 21 months is what some cards out there are offering. And of course, that's because because that after that period of time, you'll get knocked into the variable interest rate, which you do not want to be in.
For sure. And you definitely don't want to get hit with the penalty interest rate as well, which oftentimes is even higher. And so you can avoid that by making sure that you make, at the very least, your minimum payments every month on time. But yeah, another downside to balance transfer credit cards are the fact that they have balance transfer fees, which are typically 3-5% of the amount that you're transferring. If you haven't been listening long, you might not know that Matt and I, we hate fees, but we've already talked about it on this episode, so you should know. Fees are kind of our nemesis, but this is definitely a big reason to avoid balance transfers, if at all possible. You know, paying $500 on a $10,000 transfer, that's a lot of money.
That's real money right there, yeah.
We don't want you doing that. But yeah, if you just don't have the money on hand, then fortunately there are some cards that don't charge this balance transfer fee. Specifically, look to your local credit union, as oftentimes you'll find the best options there. But even a nationwide credit union like Navy Federal has an option where you can avoid those fees too. We'll link to that specific card in our show notes. We also have an updated article on howtomoney.com for you to find the balance transfer cards with the best terms, because like we said, the terms can vary and it can make hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of difference. You want to make sure you're avoiding fees at every turn. So yeah, we'll put a link to that article and to that card up on our site, because you want to make sure you're getting the right product if you are going to opt for a balance transfer card. But like Matt said, when it comes down to it, cutting your spending to make sure that balance transfer cards don't have a place in your future is the best move.
Yes, most definitely. All right, that's going to be it for questions. Joel, let's go ahead and get to the beer that you and I enjoyed on this episode, which was a Bell's Two Hearted Ale. This is an American IPA, and I will go ahead and kick this off. I can't say just Two Hearted Ale, because it's always been Bell's Two Hearted. I don't know if that's just because I didn't know of any other Bell's beers at the time. And so when I first came upon this beer, I would always call it a Bell's Two Hearted. And so that's a brief history of Matt and his relationship to this beer.
Yeah, I mean, this beer has been around quite a long time. And when it was released, it was basically like one of the best IPAs out there, because there were so few good beers. It was back in like the craft beer dark ages, basically. Like, it was like Sierra Nevada and
years
Bell's.
Ago, yeah.
Or no, like 20 years ago.
Really? That long ago?
Bell's and Sierra Nevada have been around a really long time, and they really kicked off the whole craft beer revolution. So, and I think this is still a really solid beer. It has like, it's more of like the piney than the fruity vibes going on, but I kind of appreciate that. It's not a style that I gravitate towards as much as I used to, but this is still a delicious beer. It's kind of got slightly biscuity vibes going on along with the pine. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I don't know. I like this beer, probably because of the nostalgia, but it's also still tasty.
Yes, the nostalgia with this beer is incredibly strong. Like, I can't drink this beer and not think I'm sitting in Soba, which is our local Vietnamese dive restaurant, if you want to get some pho. It's basically like the closest restaurant to us in East Atlanta where you can get some pho. And every single time, like, it makes me think of so many date nights when Kate and I would go there. She would get a bowl of pho. I would get the 31, I think. That's the pork with the rice. So good, but we would each get a glass of Bell's Two Hearted.
Now you're making me hungry.
It's it's such a great combination. It's really taking me back. But yeah, this is a classic beer. You mentioned the pine notes, the grapefruit notes. I feel like kind of stand out with this beer as well. And it led, just generally speaking, to that West Coast IPA style that had a lot of those like more grapefruit, pithy kind of notes that you found in those West Coast IPAs. But this is a solid, well-balanced, a little bit malty, but mostly hoppy ale. I am incredibly grateful that Chris donated this one to the show. Bell's is always going to have a spot in our beer fridge, especially when it's empty. It means there's a lot more room in there. But that's going to be it for this episode. Listeners can find our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com. We'll make sure to link to any of the different resources or things that we mentioned during this episode.
No doubt. So until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.